Okay.
It occurred to me that one very controversial topic that's particularly timely is the topic of the Heter Mechira for Shemitah. Is that a topic that's a legitimate subject? Sorry?
Go for it.
Okay, so let's go with that.
Torah is Torah.
That's what I hear. Yeah, especially in our Torah. Okay, so let's go with that. I think that's a topic which, as we'll see, has unfortunately drawn tremendous amounts of controversy. It's actually a perpetual motion machine for machlokas, because it was intensely controversial about 140 years ago when it was first really utilized. And every 7 years, it gets renewed as a controversy. Not just that it's continuing, but every 7 years, there's a new basis for the controversy to say, okay, even if you didn't agree with me last time, by now, for sure, you have to agree with me because everything has changed in the past 7 years. So it's not just that the machlokes continues or pops up again, but gets new fuel every cycle with new details to debate. So it has been a topic of intense controversy. And it's worth at the outset trying to understand a little bit why. So just to give a little bit of a framework and to try to understand how it fits in historically and how it fits in conceptually. And then we'll try to look at some of the details. And this is a topic where one could go all day because there is quite a bit to say. I can't go all day because I do have a flight. But that's the only reason. But we will try to keep it limited and try to get as much of the basic foundation behind it as possible. There is, but we theoretically have an hour at the outside. That's the... Okay. So just to try to sketch out a little bit some of the details, but first to try to give a little bit of a framework. I was speaking with a kollel this week about Mechiras Chametz. They're learning Pesachim. And it's noteworthy and helpful maybe to start off by illustrating the fact that there is a big difference in controversy level. Mechiras Chametz is also controversial, and it probably also could qualify as a topic in this slot, but the difference in controversy level is very significant. So Mechiras Chametz has a history of controversy and still has different levels of comfort as far as people, how they relate to it, but it's nowhere near as radioactive as the Heter Mechira issue. The Heter Mechira controversy is significantly greater. And to try to understand why that is, why should it be that so many who do accept Mechiras Chametz to a certain extent aren't as happy with the Heter Mechira, when one could argue that on the surface they seem comparable. And in fact, one of the great supporters of the Heter Mechira was a great goon by the name of Shulam Mikutno, and he thought that they were comparable. He thought that there is basis to accept it on the foundation that we have accepted Mechiras Chametz, and he found them to be essentially on the same level. So it's worth taking a minute to try to understand how it is that they are viewed differently. And with that, maybe to look at all of the devices just for a second, the different mechanisms that exist which address challenges in halacha, which have had different levels of acceptance, and to ask the question why. Why is it that they have different levels of acceptance? You know, I tell a joke that the rabbis have decided to prohibit smoking, but the Orthodox Jews are not worried. They're just going to sell their lungs to a non-Jew. So for the record, that doesn't work. Don't try that at home. But it prompts the question, so what is it about that? And what is it that works? And what is it that doesn't work? So in terms of how these tools are accepted or not accepted, and there's so many more that one could talk about that would certainly take all day. But the framework one could suggest, I think it's basically an algorithm that you can use to assess just how controversial something will be, to what extent a certain plan will be accepted, will be disputed, will be somewhere in between, will be begrudgingly accepted. It is probably contingent on the application of the following algorithm. It's basically a three-part formula, really four parts, because one of them is going to break down into two parts. So the first part is the question of the letter of the law, that we first and foremost are going to need to satisfy the basic requirements of halacha. So if the plan that's being suggested is consistent with halacha, so then that's first step one. If it's not, it's going to be a non-starter. We're going to have to first satisfy the basic standards of halacha, which really also breaks down into two parts, because that could mean the question of whether it actually works, whether it's actually effective in what it's striving to do, or in some cases, and this is something we'll see, it might be that it might be effective, but there may be halachic issues anyway. There might be halachic reasons not to do it, even if it is effective. So that's category one, the letter of the law. How does this plan comply with halacha in a foundational sense? The second column, and this one certainly breaks down into two parts, is the question of the spirit of the law. Is what you are proposing consistent with the spirit of the law? And this is really the area where we will find the most challenges with a lot of the suggestions that come up in various areas of halacha, and there are so many more. And truth is, maybe if we have time to come back before Rosh Hashanah, we could talk about Prizbul, because Prizbul is the other half of what's going on this year, and Prizbul has a much older pedigree, and therefore a much greater level of acceptance. It goes back to the Mishnah, but it's also a tool that has been greatly misunderstood as far as what it represents in terms of the ability of halacha to seemingly change, seemingly adapt to certain challenges. So there's a lot to discuss about that, but this whole issue of how does whatever we're doing, whatever we're proposing, how does it match up with the spirit of the law is very much a crucial question to ask. And you say it breaks down into two halves, because one question is the spirit of the halacha as we perceive the intent of the Torah, which is often speculative. Sometimes it's explicit in the Torah, very often it's not. So very often it's our effort to try to understand what the Torah's intent is and how faithful are we to that. And the second half of the spirit of the law is, let's say in these examples that we're talking about today, when there's a claim that we're executing a sale, so how genuine is that sale? Is that compliant with the spirit of a sale? Or does that seem to be somewhat of a misrepresentation and maybe the sale is not so genuine? So to go back to our example of selling the lungs in order to get around the prohibition of smoking, so that fails already on two of our grounds, because on ground one, the letter of the law, it's not really going to make a difference. You're not going to be any healthier if you smoke with your lungs having been officially signed away to someone else. And also on this ground, let's say the question of how genuine is the sale. Well, let's say you did write a deed of sale and get a purchase price for your lungs, but you then proceeded for the rest of your life to walk around with the lungs still in your body. So how much would that really line up with a sale? You could call it a sale, but would you really believe that you actually sold your lungs? Would that have any noticeable impact on your life? Presumably not. So that's the kind of area where there is what's the question there as well. And the third part of a formula is the issue of need. Because presumably, we wouldn't want to deviate at all from what the Torah is describing if there wasn't some degree of need to do so. In perfect circumstances, we'd rather just follow the law exactly as written. So if there's any kind of a suggestion to do anything differently, so presumably there's got to be some reason, some push to do that. And the degree to which the need has urgency is going to be a big part of the equation also. So especially if column one and column two are a little bit weaker, so then a greater need in the third column, a greater urgency can carry the burden when there's less of a strong foundation for column one and column two. So far, so good. Does that make sense, more or less? Okay, so I think you could use that formula to try to analyze every one of these devices and try to figure out why they are controversial or not controversial, why they're more accepted, why they're less accepted. And just as another second part of the introduction, so when you use that formula, and we'll get into much more detail about all of these aspects, time permitting, but if you compare Mechiras Chametz, the selling of Chametz before Pesach, and the Het Mechira, which if we haven't spelled it out yet, that refers to the selling of land in Israel to allow the land to continue to be worked during the Shemitah year, if you compare these two, so I think you could highlight at least six differences between them. And four of the differences favor Mechiras Chametz, make Mechiras Chametz less controversial, more accepted. And two of them would favor Hetem Mechira, which helps to give a little bit of perspective on the complexity of some of these issues. So what are the six differences? Just to give us a little bit of a preview, and we'll go into more detail, time permitting, God willing, about all of them. But the first is, we'll see, that when it comes to Hetem Mechira, there is a significant Torah prohibition that poses an obstacle. And that's not relevant to Mechiras Chametz. And the truth is, that could already explain all of the controversy, or all of the difference in the controversy, just the weight of that Torah prohibition and how that was debated. So that already separates Hetem Mechira and Mechiras Chametz in a significant way, and we'll talk about that. The next two differences have to do with 2b, column 2, the second part, about the spirit of the law in terms of the sale. So just how genuine is the sale? So two ways in which, and there really are more, but two ways in which the sale of chametz might be taken as a little bit more genuine and sincere than the sale of land in Israel for the Shemitah year. So one is that when we sell our chametz before Pesach, and I'm referring here to consumers of chametz, not necessarily to a store that's continuing to do business with chametz, but let's say most of us as consumers are selling our chametz before Pesach, and we don't have anything to do with the chametz over the course of Pesach. It's locked away, and we are completely separated from it, at least during that time. When the land is sold, it is sold so that it can be worked. So it's sold in order to maintain a connection to that which is being sold. So one could argue, as far as the commitment to the sale, that's a very significant difference. A second difference also, and there really are many more in this category, is that when we sell our chametz, so it's basically for economic reasons. So if somebody were, the purchaser were to come to us after Pesach and say, you know, I've decided I do want to keep the chametz, and I'll write you out a check for the entire value of the chametz, I think we'd probably say, all right, take it. Fine, sir, write out the check, and you can keep the chametz. And fine, the sale went through, finally. We're okay with that. If following the Shemitah year, if the Arab purchaser of the land is going to come and say, okay, I've got a check here from the Bank of Dubai for however many trillions of dollars, and we'd like to keep all this land in Israel, I'd hope we'd probably say we're not interested. We're not interested in the sale being permanent. And that is also a significant difference. The fourth difference has to do with the whole spirit of the law issue in a very broad sense. And these issues, these tools, are often used, the term that's often used for them, the Hebrew term, is the term harama, which harama is a difficult term to translate. In fact, it's a significantly difficult term to translate. The Rishonim have different theories as to how it's used in the Torah, how it's used in the Mishnah. It could be that it's used differently in the Torah and the Mishnah. So there's a lot behind the effort to try to translate it. We normally would translate it as evasion or something like that. And it has sometimes a judgmental tone, and sometimes it has a neutral tone. Sometimes it's just a necessary working around when there is a challenge that is difficult to address otherwise, so we avoid the challenge if we're able to. So the judgment level of harama varies from usage to usage, and the comfort level with harama varies from usage to usage. So it also has to do with the degree of just how much you are working around. And this goes again to our second column here, 2a, the spirit of the law. There is a very significant difference here, which really deserves a lot more attention than it gets. Now, when we talk about selling the land in Israel, so the Torah says, don't work the land during Shemitah, and the land is being sold so that it can be worked. So that's really the opposite of the intent of the spirit of the law. When it comes to chametz, so there the Torah says don't own chametz during Pesach. And the chametz is being sold as a different way of not owning Chametz on Pesach. You would think you have to destroy it, and here you're selling it for this period as a different way of addressing the ownership question. Is it adequate? That's a big debate, and there has been a lot argued about that point. But it's not the opposite. It's not the opposite of the Torah's intent, and maybe it doesn't even deviate very much at all from the Torah's intent, and that's where there is a lot of debate as far as how to relate to Mechiras Chametz. But we could see why that would be a big difference as far as deviation from the spirit of the law. There is a very significant difference as far as that's concerned. So far, so good. Everything makes sense. So those are four differences that favor Mechiras Chametz. There are at least two differences that would favor the Hetzer Mechira. So one of them has to do with another Harama issue. There is another major factor in considering the acceptability of Haramos, of these workarounds, when they're comfortable, when people are okay with them, and when they're less okay with them. Very often there's a distinction that is drawn between Torah law and rabbinic law. That there's an attitude, which if we had another hour, we could explain in more detail, but there's an attitude that when it comes to Torah law, we don't want any games, we don't want any deviations, so there's no room for haramos. When it comes to rabbinic law, there's more of an acceptability for haramos. Now that sounds like it's a little bit disdainful of rabbinic law. God forbid, shouldn't be taken that way. And the truth is, I think there's a much more fundamental way to explain it, but for now, that's the basic attitude that exists in some places, not everywhere, but that's an attitude that you can find drawing that distinction. So if that is indeed a significant distinction, so that should make a difference here, because when it comes to the ownership of chametz on Pesach, that is prohibited by Torah law. Ba'ira, ba'imatzei is an iser min ha-Torah. When it comes to Shemitah, so you'll tell me, you read Parshas Behar and Parshas Re'eh, it's also a Torah law. However, the attitude of many is that nowadays Shemitah is only mandated rabbinically. And why that is, it could be because of the connection to Yovel, which is not practiced today. It could be to a connection to Meiser, which may be only applicable on a rabbinic level today. It has to do with the settlement of the Jews in Israel and the fact that most of the Jews are not living in Israel. It's probably not true what is sometimes assumed, that if you're watching the population counts that we're just like one nefesh b'nefesh flight away from it, then the next flight is going to tip the balance and all of a sudden Shemitah is going to be Minat Torah. It's probably not accurate, because the connection to Yovel, actually, the Gemara says, requires everyone to be living, not just most, but everyone to be living in Israel. And this is harder, they have to be living in their original ancestral portions by the Shvatim, so that we certainly are not on the verge of just yet, unless there's a major change. The issue when it comes to Meiser, which is also contingent on the population, talk about Bias Kulchem, there it may be more workable for a majority, but here the poskim also understand it means that if there's a mass aliyah and most of the Jews go at once, and there are a few left over, okay, so it's still then most of the Jews living in Israel, but not bit by bit. Again, counting how many are on the next flight is not going to tip the difference. So this is not necessarily on the verge of changing any minute, unless, of course, Mashiach comes. God willing, that could happen any minute. But as far as just simply following the demographic trends, it's not necessarily on the verge of changing right away. So there is some debate about this, about whether Shemitah is actually Torah law or rabbinic law today. But certainly anyone who advocates the Hetzer Mechira is working off that premise, that the presumption is that Shemitah today is rabbinic, and that is a necessary step for the Hetzer Mechira to work. So that, if that's the case, so one could take the position that the Hetzer Mechira is more acceptable than Mechiras Chametz because it's dealing with rabbinic law. I spent a lot of time a few years ago trying to nail down exactly Rabbi Soloveitchik's opinion on the Hetzer Mechira. It wasn't so simple. But one thing I did find someone quoting that he said he was in Rav Soloveitchik's shir in the 70s, and he said he told him he was about to take a trip to Eretz Yisrael, and it was a Shemitah year, and he asked him if he should rely on the Hetzer Mechira, and he quoted that Rav Soloveitchik said to him, "Well, do you sell your chametz?" And the person said, "I do." So he said, "Okay, if you rely on it for Torah law, presumably you can rely on it for rabbinic law as well." So there is that level of argument, which would make Hetzer Mechira more acceptable than Mechiras Chametz. And the other factor, factor number six on our total list, is this last column of need. And this, I heard in the name of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, that Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was asked, what did he think about the Hetzer Mechira? And that he said, really all comes down to one question. He says, is it necessary? If it's really necessary, then we'll need to use it. If it's not so necessary, so then better not to use it. And that question of need, of just how necessary it is or isn't, is one of the factors that's part of the perpetual motion machine of Machlokas that is always being relitigated, as you can assume. It is somewhat subjective and hard to assess exactly how necessary it is or isn't, and there are many different efforts to mitigate some of the challenges of the Shemitah year, which do also affect the equation. But just to give an example of how it's subjective and how it flips and how each side is always going to feel like recent events transform the argument in their favor. So the whole question of pre-state and post-state takes on great significance for this question for a lot of reasons, but in this particular issue of need, so it's invoked, depending on what side you're on, in both directions. So there were those who argued that, look, it was one thing before there was a state, so we were just dealing with a few kibbutzim, a few moshavim that had these scattered families. Okay, that wasn't necessarily so urgent. But now you have a whole country whose economy depends on it, so clearly now for sure we have to use the Hetzer Mechira. And there are others who will say just the exact opposite, that once upon a time, so you had these scattered settlements that didn't have any government to take care of them, and they needed the Hetzer Mechira in order to survive. But now we have a government, it's a startup nation, it's a world power on the economic level, so no, there's no longer any need for the Hetzer Mechira. So it's just one of the many examples how any development in the past many cycles has been invoked in both directions as part of some of the subjective assessments of why, even if you didn't agree with me then, now for sure you should agree with me, whatever your position is. So this is a part of it, but this assessment of need is a major part of the discussion as well. Okay, so far so good. So with that second introduction, so let's see how many of the details we can fill in the remaining time that we have. So the implementation of the Hetzer Mechira was controversial from day one. And there were suggestions earlier, but it really came to public attention in the 1880s. When there were these settlements that were scattered around at that time. And there certainly was dire economic need. The question of how they were surviving in the first place was itself an issue, even without Shemitah. But certainly to take off for that year and figure out how they were going to make it was certainly scary. And this idea was proposed. Again, it had been proposed earlier, but was being proposed again at that time. And there were great rabbinic leaders who did support it, including Shmuel Zalman Klapfish, and we mentioned Shmuel Mikutno, Shmuel Moliver. And it was endorsed. I'm here representing Yeshiva Rabbeinu Yitzchok Hanan, a word from our sponsor, Rabbi Yitzchok Hanan Spector, who was the Gadol Hador at the time. So he... Schechter sometimes says it like that, a word from our sponsor. So Rabbi Yitzchok Hanan was the Gadol Hador, and he also endorsed the plan of the Hetzer Mechira. There was controversy right at the outset. There were allegations that he wasn't given all the facts from Yitzchok Hanan, or that the endorsement was forged, and there was great anguish that he expressed at the time that there was so much controversy about it. But indeed, that was the plan that began at that point. The name of Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, the first chief rabbi of the land, is a name that is often associated with the Hetzer Mechira. That was also a process that originally, when he was living in Europe, Rav Kook and his father-in-law, the Adaret, they both were opposed to the Hetzer Mechira at that time. They did not accept it initially, and only when they came to the land and they saw just how dire the circumstances were, that then they thought this was something that did need to be supported. And then Rav Kook's name became very associated with the Hetzer Mechira. He wrote a sefer, Shabbos Haaretz, about Shemitah, and also many of his tshuvos in a sefer, Mishpat Kohen, talk about the details of the Hetzer Mechira. So he eventually became one of the most well-known associated names with the Hetzer Mechira, but he was not originally in favor. And he also writes in much of his literature about this topic that he's hesitant to go into too much detail because he doesn't think that this is something that should be entrenched forever. He doesn't think that this is something that should be taken as lachadchila or permanent. This is something that's necessary for now, and he'll explain why it's acceptable at this step, but he doesn't want it to be formalized and made permanent, so therefore he writes that he has hesitation as far as how much detail to go into it and what kind of tone to take as far as advocating, because he did have this ambivalence which continued even when he became the most notable advocate for the Hetzer Mechira. So what is the basic premise of the Hetzer Mechira? This is highly technical, but just to give a little bit of a background. So there is a debate that appears a number of times, 5 or 6 times in the Talmud and the Mishnayos, about the question of Yesh Kinyan Lahavkia or Ein Kinyan Lahavkia, which would mean if one would sell land in Israel to non-Jewish ownership, does that have the impact of being mafkia, which means does that have the effect of removing the holiness from the land? And therefore, the halachos that are connected to the holiness of the land would no longer apply. So it's brought up in the Talmud, really in connection with Meiser and a few other things, but presumably it should impact also Shemitah. If land was sold into non-Jewish hands, this was a debate in the Talmud, should that have the effect of removing the Kedusha? And therefore, the related halachos wouldn't apply under those circumstances. So this is a matter that wasn't really resolved in the debate in the Talmud, and continued to be debated among the Rishonim. In the commentaries later, it was also debated, was not really fully resolved. But there was a major voice, the Sefer HaTrumah and the Vilna Gaon and a few others, who maintained that a very significant detail would be whether we're dealing with rabbinic law or Torah law. That perhaps we should assume, as there were some indications in the earlier sources distinguished between different areas within Israel, which may have different levels of Kedusha, that if we're dealing with Torah-level Kedusha, so then maybe that would impact and result in not making a difference if the land was sold. But if we're dealing with rabbinic law, so then maybe there's more room to say that selling the land should make a difference and should remove the Kedusha, at least for some limited purpose. So that was a position that many took. And here, in this case, the assumption that we're dealing with rabbinic law had a number of bases. So there were those who said, like we noted before, that maybe Shemitah itself is rabbinic today because of the reasons we mentioned before, having to do with the population standards set in Hilchos Yovel or in Hilchos Meiser. And there are those who maintain that the whole Kedusha Saaretz, the whole land of Israel, is only sanctified on a rabbinic level today, based on the premise, also a debate in the Talmud, that the sanctification of Ezra was only meant to be for his time and not meant to extend past the exile. So nowadays, whatever attitude we have of the sanctity of the land is coming from a rabbinic perspective, does not necessarily have the status of Kedusha Min HaTorah. So there were those who took this position that being that we're dealing with rabbinic law, so maybe we should be able to say that there is basis to impact when the land is sold, yesh kinyan lahafkia, that should change things and the land should be permitted. There were a lot of details that were debated within this. This connects to really a separate debate between the Mabit and the Ma'arit, the father and son team, who argued with the Beis Yosef, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, about the general question of the sanctity of fruits that were grown in land that was owned by non-Jews. And the position of the Beis Yosef was that they would not have sanctity, although it doesn't necessarily address the question of whether it's legitimate to sell the land for that purpose, or the question of a license to work the land during such a scenario. It just addresses the question of the resulting status of the fruits that would be grown under those circumstances. So that's a part of the complexity here. There's a lot of back and forth about that. And even though most do assume, like the Beis Yosef, that the peros that come out of such ownership would not have sanctity, but it doesn't necessarily equate to endorsing the whole plan. In fact, I saw once a whole sefer that was written defending the position of the Beis Yosef about this question that the sanctity should not apply to fruit that was owned by non-Jews. And one of the maskimim, one of those who wrote a haskama to the sefer, said, "This is a wonderful sefer defending the position of the Beis Yosef, and hopefully in the merit of learning this great sefer, no one should have to rely on the terrible hetem mechira." So apparently one doesn't necessarily lead to the other. There's still a lot of steps in between. But it's a part of the equation. And the details, such as whether it means the sale itself is legitimate or whether it means that one could work the land in order to produce these peros, is indeed a separate question. And the Chazon Ish, who is one of the most fierce opponents of the Hetem Mechira, the Chazon Ish took the position, or he expressed in his writings, he said that, you see, it's terrible because the original arrangement was supposed to be that all of the work would be done by non-Jews. And he says it's not really going to play out that way. It doesn't actually play out that way. They're not able to get non-Jews to do the work, so the Jews end up doing the work, and they'll say, what can we do? We don't have any choice. And that's just another reason, he writes, why he's so upset about it. So it's not clear why that should be necessary, or there's a distinction that's sometimes drawn between avoda on the land that is rabbinically prohibited as far as that is Torah prohibited. It's not 100% clear why that should necessarily be necessary on top of the other assumptions that we're dealing with rabbinic law to begin with, which would make all of it rabbinically prohibited. So there's a lot of debate, but that's a part of the back and forth. There were other considerations that were also brought in together with this, the fact that there is an opinion in Rishonim that seems to maintain, the Baal HaMor, that Shemitah nowadays is not Rabbanan, is not even obligatory at all. That it's only called Amidas Chasidus. It's only what's called a good thing to do, but it's not necessarily obligatory on any level. So there were those who argued that could be brought in, that a minority opinion could be brought in a situation of great need, and every detail here is controversial. So there were those who said, no, it's not even a minority opinion, it's completely rejected because it's such a tiny minority, or it only really applied to Shemitah's Ksafim against canceling loans, didn't apply to the land, it's not what the Baal HaMor was talking about. And there are those who go on the other extreme and say, no, I can actually find you more Rishonim who said like him, so it's not even a minority position, so for sure we can factor that in. There's a statement in the Talmud in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which refers to a time where the Jews were working the land during Shemitah because of a certain oppressive tax that was being put upon them. And Tosfos tries to figure out what's going on, why is that a justification to work the land during Shemitah just because they had a hard time paying this tax. And there the Rishonim discuss, is it because Shemitah was considered rabbinic at that time and therefore there was more latitude? Is it because there is a level that rises to pikuach nefesh, that maybe the challenge of paying this tax was so severe they literally would not have been able to survive, they would have starved? Is that what was going on? So there's debate about that, and all of that gets thrown into this discussion. All of that is a part of this analysis. How do you assess the shas hadchak? How do you assess the various factors in halacha that say when there is an urgent situation, a shas hadchak, we can rely on minority opinions, we can rely on debated opinions, we can consider various factors. There were those who wanted to say that maybe it's not even the Shemitah year, that there was a debate among the Rishonim, the Rambam, and the Gaonim as to how do you count the Shemitah year. So maybe we should call that a Safek in and of itself. We're not really sure what year is the Shemitah year. And if we're not really sure, so then it's a Safek, Rabbinic law, Safek Rabbanim Lakula. So let's assume it's not the Shemitah year at all. So the Beis Halevi got very upset about that. The Beis Halevi was the original Rabbi Yehoshua Ben Soloveitchik, who himself was fiercely opposed to the Hetem Mechira. And the Beis Halevi wrote, don't even go there. So you're going to start talking about it's a Safek, so then I'll tell you, you actually have to be Machmir on all the possibilities, you'll have to treat 3 years of the Shemitah year. So if you want to start that conversation, you're not going to like how it ends, so don't even go there. You have no right to consider it a Safek. You have to assume this is definitely the year. And he was very opposed to such an idea. So all of these Sveikos and all of these issues were all invoked as a part of the argument that we should have the right to take a lenient position and take a clearly less than ideal path in order to try to address what was perceived as a great economic crisis and maybe an existential crisis. How are we going to make it through when there's such a challenge? Now here, an important point to appreciate, this itself is a major philosophical point. There were those among the opponents who said that the Torah is explicit about this, that it's not news that Shemitah is difficult. The Torah says in Parshas Bahar clearly that it's going to be challenging, and people are going to say, what are we going to eat? And God says, V'sivisi esperchasi, I'll make sure that there'll be enough. And the role of Emunah here is explicitly conveyed in the Torah, that we know it's hard, and yet this is what it takes. So why are we acting like this is a new development all of a sudden that Shemitah is hard? So this itself becomes a very complex point. It's interesting also that some, such as the Netziv and Velazhin, they were very opposed to the Hetem Mechiras, the Beis Halevi, the Netziv, all of them were very, very opposed. So we mentioned before that Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik and his brother Aaron Soloveitchik were quoted as having angles that were more tolerant of it, but their ancestors were very opposed in Velazhin. And so the Netziv writes in his commentary to Chumash, he thinks that the Psukim are telling you explicitly that this is something you shouldn't try to do anything to avoid, you shouldn't sell the land. He interprets Psukim to be directly saying that. Meshech Chachma has a similar comment elsewhere. So in that context, many of them say that Torah is clear that it's going to be hard, and yet this is a part of the challenge, that God says he's going to pull us through, and he's going to give us extra, and we shouldn't take this as impossible. So to this, some of the supporters responded, Reb Shul Mikutno and also Reb Yosef Engel, who was a great Gaon, lived, passed away a little bit more than 100 years ago, a great Gaon from Poland, author of incredible Sfarim. Reb Yosef Engel and others argued that the promise that the Torah gives that we'll be able to make it through, that is connected to the assumption that the Torah is commanding the observance of Shemitah. So if Shemitah is min HaTorah, so yes, there's a bracha that comes along with that. But if we're assuming that the internal rules of the Torah say that Shemitah is not obligatory now, and that we're observing it as a rabbinic obligation in order that we shouldn't forget about Shemitah, so then we don't necessarily have that promise. We don't know that we have that heavenly guarantee, and therefore we have to figure out our own way to try to make it through from A to B, and this is a theme that's going to run through this whole discussion. We're trying to get from point A to point B. This is a temporary measure. We'll get to the stage where this is not necessary, but in order to be able to survive long enough, then we don't necessarily have that promise. It's an understandable position that if it's connected to the mitzvah, then it maybe only is something we can rely on when the mitzvah is in effect. But if the mitzvah isn't in effect, then we are rabbinically adopting it. So the position was, we don't necessarily have that same promise or any prohibition to find other ways to address it, and therefore this is something that we may have to find a different path to look at. So that was all a part of the debate as far as the background of how it works and what exactly was the opening premise. Now, a major part of the controversy And this also goes a lot to some of the philosophical aspects. We mentioned at the outset that column one has a significant concern here, and we said that the first of our six differences that really by itself could explain a lot of the difference in acceptance between the Hetta Mechira and the Mechiras Chametz has to do with Lo Sechanin, that the Torah has a prohibition which is difficult to translate, but the Talmud says in Avodah Zarah, among other interpretations, Lo Sitein Lehem Chanoya Bekarka Klal, that we're not permitted to sell land in Israel outside of Jewish hands. We're not permitted to sell away the land in Israel to non-Jews. So if that's the case, so then many argue, so what are you doing here? So the whole thing is a Torah prohibition. So even if it would work, but it's just not allowed to do it. And this was the position of many of the detractors. Many of the detractors understood that maybe it would be effective, that land that was sold would indeed not have Kedusha, but the sale itself was prohibited. So that's the part of what we highlighted in discussing that first column. How does it match with Torah law? So there's two ways in which it could deviate from Torah law theoretically. It may simply not have the desired effect, or it may have the effect, but there may be a prohibition. So that's how many understood that there was a prohibition here, and how could it even be considered? And among the great detractors, like we said before, the Netziv here in his Truvas, Meshiv Davar, before we were referencing a Sefer on Chumash, but the Netziv in his Truvas, Meshiv Davar, has a strong objection to the Hetta Mechira, and he focuses on this. He says the whole thing doesn't make sense, because he says that according to their premise, that this is, he didn't necessarily agree that Shemitah was Drabanan, but he said according to the premise of the advocates that Shemitah is Drabanan, so why would you violate the Torah prohibition in order to address this rabbinic obligation? And the way he said it, he says they're either running away from a lion in order to run into a wolf, or a wolf to run into a lion. I forgot which one is worse, but whichever animal is worse. So they're running away from the less dangerous animal and then in order to run into the more dangerous animal. So he doesn't understand why they would do this. It's a Torah prohibition of itself. So better to just violate Shemitah the way he understood it rather than to sell the land and think that's a better solution. So a lot of the objection was on that. The most extreme version of the objection was the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish maintained, and here it's a deviation from the position of most of the detractors we said before, Chazon Ish maintained there's a principle in the Talmud, Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira, that if you try to commit a transgression through an agent, so then that doesn't work. So what does it mean it doesn't work? So most of the Rishonim understand it means that it doesn't trace back to the original sender. So everyone's responsible for their own moral behavior. So if I ask somebody else to do a transgression on my behalf, and he knows it's a transgression, so he can't blame me. It's his decision to listen to me instead of listening to God. That's how most of the Rishonim understand. However, the Chazon Ish was using the minority view in Tosfos and Kiddushin that Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira means that the action doesn't take effect. So here, the land was basically being sold by agents. It wasn't being sold by the individual farmers. Sorry, so there's no shlichus. That's how he understood it, that the shlichus doesn't take effect, and therefore the sale doesn't happen. So therefore, he was in the minority view that it's not only prohibited, but because it's prohibited, it doesn't work. So most felt that it did work, but it's prohibited. Most of the detractors felt that it did work, but it's prohibited. Chazon Ish felt that because of how they do it, it doesn't even work. He agreed that if the farmer himself were decided to sell the land directly, so okay, that would be prohibited, but would work. But because it happens through the Rabbanut, it was happening through the agency of others, so therefore it didn't even have effect. So there's a lot of debate about this and about the parameters of Lo Sechanim. And Rav Kook addressed a lot of this in his Shuvos, and there are a number of points without getting into every detail, but among the details that he discussed was the question of, is this applicable to Muslims? Maybe the prohibition only applies to genuine idolaters, and maybe if the Muslims who are around believe in one God, so therefore maybe there isn't a prohibition of Lo Sechanim. in that context. And he also then suggested that's why this wasn't something we found in earlier generations, because before that point in history, it was hard to find a non-Jew in the land who wasn't an actual idolater. But now so many of the non-Jews who live in Israel are Muslims and not necessarily idolaters, so it wouldn't necessarily apply. And that was one suggestion he had. It also suggests, it mentions a number of suggestions. A lot of them are not so compelling on their own, but the suggestion is all a part of it, that maybe one who already owns some land, there's no additional prohibition to have more land. It's also a question of whether this should apply to a temporary sale, to a sale that was designed to revert to the original owner after a period of time. Now here, there's a tremendous complexity in threading the needle, because you need more than just to lend out the land or to rent out the land. You need a sale that is real enough to meet the standard of removing it from Kedusha, but also not significant enough in order to violate Los Sachanim. So threading the needle between those two points, very, very narrow space, is understandably complex, and that is a big part of the debate, a big part of the discussion. But what is crucial to appreciate here is that a lot of this machlokas is philosophical as well, and really represents also two different aspects of the goal here. So many of those who defend the Hetem Mechira from the argument of Lo Sachanim argue, understandably, that the main Lo Sachanim would be to let the settlement in Israel falter, that we're trying to build up the Jewish population in the land. It should be strong enough so we can get to an ultimate redemption. And if, again, we can't make it from A to B because we can't survive long enough, we can't endure past the Shemitah years, so Ein Lecha Lo Sachanim Gadol Mizeh. There's no greater violation of the capital Lamed Tuf Lo Sachanim than letting the land as a whole slip out of Jewish hands, because we can't maintain the process of building up the Jewish settlement of the land. So this was a major part of the debate about kind of focusing on Lo Sachanim in the immediate sense, and a broader goal of Lo Sachanim was a major part of the discussion. And there are some who point to Aran and Gittin. If Cook has this in his Shuvas, that at some point to Aran and Gittin, who says that if the act is for the benefit of the Jew, it's not a violation of Lo Sachanim. So others argued, but that can't be applicable here. That's applicable to another statement in the Gemara, talks about giving gifts to a non-Jew, to an idolater. So there, the Ran was saying that if it's not just a gift, it's something that's helpful for the Jew, so it's not a violation of Lo Sachanim. But we're talking about selling land. Sale is always mutually beneficial. Somebody always sells something and then gets paid for it. So still, we assume there's a prohibition of selling anyway. So you can't say that's an exception. And others explain that the point is broader than that. What they mean by invoking the benefit of the Jew, meaning it's the tovas ha'yishuv, that it's for the benefit of the continuity of the settlement overall, and therefore that itself goes to the whole purpose of Lo Sachanim, and that should be understood as far as the motivation of what was being invoked here. So that itself is a major back and forth, a major machlokas, exactly how to appreciate these different elements. And that very much goes to the core of what's being debated, a part of the Lo Sachanim. So it's also noted that if one chooses not to use the Hetem Mechira, so very often that means purchasing produce from neighboring non-Jews who may be actively engaged in war against the Jewish people. So once again, the argument is invoked, Ein lecha lo sachanim gadol mizeh, that what works more against maintaining Jewish control of the land than actively supporting those who are in the process of waging war against it. There was an article I saw a few cycles ago in the Jordanian Times, talking about just how excited the farmers there are, looking forward to the Shemitah year because their economy is going to get such a boom. More recently, I saw somebody highlighting an interview where they were talking to some of the farmers in Gaza, so they don't know much about Shemitah. They call it the religious year, but some actually understood that it was a commandment in the Torah that every 7 years you have to give gifts to your enemies in order to accomplish some goal. So there is a concern here that some of the effects could indeed have an impact, which all works against Lo Sechanim in an even more meta, in an even more macro significant way, and that also becomes a major part of the debate. There were a lot of other issues that also got invoked. Like we mentioned before, the creation of the state certainly had a major impact. So there were some, such as Rav Gorin and others, who felt that that totally redefines everything, that the whole notion of Yesh Kinyan, to say that the land changes because it's sold from a Jew to a non-Jew, that's when you have lands owned by an individual Jew, but when you have a Jewish government, the whole country is Jewish. So to say that any individual selling the land can change the Jewish status of the land, so that's very difficult to say. Some Rav Gorin thought it was tremendously difficult to say. That position, that objection, has been attributed to many, including even the Satmar Rav. Satmar Rav apparently felt that, you see, the Medina messes up everything, even messes up the Het Mechira, that you can't any longer have a basis to say that it's possible. And other issues about the validity of the sale were also raised. There are many, many complexities. Nowadays, the sale is administered by Rav Weitman, Rav Zev Weitman, who's also the Rav of Tenuva, who's done a lot to try to bring it in line as much as possible. He's not personally a huge fan of the Het Mechira. He advocates other methods, but it's his job to administer it, so he's done as much as he can to try to adapt whatever he can in order to make it as solid as possible to the extent that it's being utilized. And it's tricky because you have to make sure that the farmers actually know what they're doing, and many of them don't necessarily believe in it at all, or don't necessarily believe in halacha at all. So the question of how much sincerity is in the sale continues to come back and to be a concern. Once upon a time, it was an issue that it's against the law, that it's against the Din of the Malchusa, because the land sold in Israel has to be registered in the Tabu, which is a holdover from the Turkish administration, how they record all land being sold. And if this is not going through that process, so then that raises a host of problems. Maybe it's a problem, it's not Dina de Malchusa, it's not in accordance with the land, the law of the land. It's not something, therefore, that the seller takes seriously because he knows that it's not going through the process. That itself could bring all kinds of problems. So in the 1970s, the Knesset passed a law for the purposes of Shemitah that the land sold for the Het Mechira doesn't have to be recorded in the Tabu. So that either helps or hurts, depending on what you're focusing on, because maybe it addresses the legality of it, but maybe it reinforces the perception that it's not a serious sale, that this doesn't have to go through the normal channels and is even recorded like that legally. So these are some of the back and forths that we see about the issues of the Het Mechira, and there's controversy addressed, there's controversy contained in every step along the way, but there's nothing more controversial than going overtime, so I'm going to wrap it up in the next minute. But I do want to highlight that a part of what emerges is that we see that there is a tension here, and that really both sides are coming from the same place. Both sides are looking to try to figure out how can we best honor the spirit of Shemitah and the spirit of Yishuv Haaretz, and both sides are looking for a time when everything will be able to be done glat kedasu kedin, and when Shemitah will be min haTorah, and no one will have to rely on that. And until then, we have all kinds of imperfections and concerns on both sides. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein wrote an article a number of Shemitah cycles ago that's been widely quoted and translated and disseminated, where he referred to Shemitah in his day, really a few cycles ago, as a halachic tragedy. because there is no one who's really doing it perfectly. Everything has some of the weaknesses that we've mentioned, and everyone thinks that they're better than everyone else because the way they're doing it, even though they have these problems. And that's a part of what we are living with nowadays. So to be able to appreciate that really everyone is coming from the same commitment, everyone is looking to try to get to that point where there will be a perfect settlement of the land and where Shemitah will be able to be observed in all of its hidurim and all of its details without any evasion. But the question is just how to get there. I saw a letter, my great-great-grandfather was one of the early rabbinic Zionist voices, was an associate of Rav Shmuel Molliver and others, and he wrote letters that were printed in a sefer called Shivas Sion. And there, I guess he was writing already in the late 1800s, and he says he doesn't understand some of the objections people have to the Jews who were settling the land then and what they were doing. And he says some of them are objecting about that their Shemitah observance isn't perfect, and they point to the fact that the Gemara says that Jews were exiled because of a lack of observance of Shemitah, and it's presumably they also had some justification for doing so. But he went on to note, he said, that that's only significant. Presumably the role of Shemitah takes on such importance because you believe that this is a step towards settling the land and bringing about that full redemption. So you have to at least acknowledge that if you're going to be so critical of the fact that they're not observing Shemitah, so recognize that it's significant because of the step of what they're doing. He says you can't do both. You can't say that their whole project is pointless and complain about their lack of perfect observance of Shemitah. Really, Shemitah takes on such significance because of that endeavor, and that should be acknowledged. You know, the Ribaz was one of the major objectors, and the Ribaz wrote to Rav Kook, he says, the whole point of settling the land is to observe the mitzvah Satulius Barat, so what's the point in going there and evading it? And Rav Kook said, he doesn't think that's the whole point. He thinks there's many other values to settling the land, and hopefully through that, we will come to also be able to do all the mitzvahs perfectly. So really, everyone is coming from the same value system in the same place and trying to figure out exactly how it is best applied. And discussions like this, shiurim on topics like this, I think the prevalent practice is to end by saying that we should all be zoche to a time when we have a full redemption and Shemitah is observed fully. So I'd like to just add to that is I think that the way in which we talk about it will play a big role in how soon we are living in a fully redeemed land where Shemitah will be fully observed. And God willing, that should be what we are privileged to see soon enough. Okay. Hi.
I have two questions.
Yes,
one is, what is the position of the Rabbi Rashid? And second question, how does this differ halakhically from Otzer Beit Din?
Yeah, Otzer Beit Din is going to require another hour. Otzer Beit Din is a much more complicated system. It involves, there are different types of Otzer Beit Din. But Otzer Beit Din involves having the land basically be understood as hefker and harvesting with that understanding that the produce is for everyone, and paying people to do the harvesting and the transporting and the delivering and the distributing. And there are many different versions of how that happens. It's based on Tosefta, the whole story. But sometimes, in some versions, it results in it actually costing more, which seems to be undermining the whole idea. There's a project right now Rabbi Dr. Ari Bergman is very involved in trying to do a system where it comes out where it's much more accessible, and he understands that to be more consistent with the spirit of the law, and the way he portrays it, that is, thinks, the most appropriate model as far as the goal of what Shemitah is going to involve. But there are detractors on that level as well. It goes back to Rav Lichtenstein's point that nobody fully satisfies everyone else. The Rabbanut does continue to administer the Hetem Mechira in a limited way. I mentioned before, Rav Eitman, I believe still, certainly a few years ago, he was the one, I believe he's still the one doing it. And he has mentioned, he's written about it extensively. He's not personally so enamored with it. And he also certainly believes that it's not really within the spirit of the law and thinks that it should be minimized for that reason. But to the extent that it's necessary, that he's worked hard to try to sharpen all the details and to solidify whatever he can, and to make the sale as genuine and as serious as possible, as limited as possible, things like that. Okay, who's up first? Sorry. Yeah. Okay. I think you're up first. Because that would really require a whole rewriting of the Torah. And so that would require a much greater deviation than we're empowered to do. And it would probably, I think one way to make things even more controversial would probably be that. Right. You're saying for agricultural purposes, like the Rambam writes. Well, we don't know exactly. That's one of the Rambam does emphasize. That's one of the theories. Is we don't know exactly what it is. There's a lot to talk about what exactly the purpose is. But we do know that we don't have the right to assume that. Therefore, we can modify the rules based on the purpose. And certainly to lose the idea that the whole land is on the Shemitah at the same time and the whole country is on the Shemitah at the same time, it's an interesting question how much the focus is the land and how much the focus is the farmers and how much the assumption is that this affects what everyone is doing. If anyone's in New York in May, we're having a conference, the Kol Olin YU was having a conference focusing on a lot of the values that emerge from Shemitah. It's one of them, but there's a lot more to consider. So we're certainly not empowered to rewrite the rules that way, and it probably would be the only way to make this even more controversial. So just in case we had maxed out eventually it would probably bring a whole new level. But you're right that the idea of it being for the purpose of the land, could there be other ways to accomplish that? It's possible, but that would both have the problem of our having more authority than we do, and also there are other components to it as well. Hi. The Netziv does work off the assumption of the Raisa. He was saying, according to them, that he's according to those who advocate it, they work off the Drabanan, and according to that premise, then why don't you just leave it with that instead of violating the Isser Daraisa of Lo Sechanim? But there were those who took the position that it's Daraisa. Rav Sternbach is a sefer where he disputes every single tzad anyone could ever take for the Hetzer Mechira. So one of them is, you know, he has a lot to say why I believe Shemitah is the right. So there are some who maintain that way. Although it does seem like there's a lot of foundation to say that it's Drabbanan based on already Gemaras and Rishonim. Okay, thank you so much. Should have a wonderful day. Should be only good things. Thank you so much.